Hello, this is Eric Morse Eskenazi. I am the host of the Iraq Dispatches podcast. Thanks for tuning in to this latest episode, which was recorded on Tuesday, February 9th. I had the distinct pleasure of interviewing photographers Arnold Arnie Zan and Margot Taussig Pinkerton, discussing their book, New Orleans, which is out now through Brilliant Publishing. We also discussed their professional careers and their love for travel. I think you'll enjoy this episode immensely. Arnie and Margot are fascinating photographers, and they've had their work exhibited in major publications, galleries, and museums. Hello. Thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break.
What basically inspired you both to get into photography? And were there any particular photographers that you studied their style or their technique then that, you know, really sparked your interest in doing it?
Why don't you go first? Right. Well, Arnie likes to go first. That's okay.
You know, both of us, actually. It's not an unusual story, but it's a story of dedication, because it's, you know, it's not easy to do what we've done, and very lucky and happy we've had a career like we've had. But I got into this because at 11 years old, a cousin got a darkroom kit, and he said, come on over, look at this. And, you know, I've heard every other photographer talk about this. It was like magic to see a print come up in the darkroom, you know, from a white sheet of paper to a print. So I was hooked from that day on, and I was always looking at the picture magazines that were out there at that time. So I said, 11 years old, I'm going to be a Life magazine photographer. And, you know, in today's world, people don't realize how unique and special it was to work for some of the people that Margot and I have worked for. So I think that was it. It was just, it filled a need for me to be able to express myself visually, and I certainly can't draw. Margot will verify that. But so it was this whole thing of being creative and producing things that I found interesting and I want to show to others.
And for me, I come from an artistic family, generations. Also photographers going back several generations. My great-grandfather, my grandmothers both, my mother. There's a lot of art that goes to our family, both painting, wood carving, needlework, photography. I mean, it makes no difference. So my parents gave me, when I was 8 years old, a little Brownie Hawkeye. Those little black boxes with the gray thumb things. And I was hooked. I found that I could not do photography, and I used the double negative advisedly. I loved it. I scrimped, I saved, I worked, because of course I had to buy my own film and take it to the local drugstore to get developed and so forth. And I had albums and so forth. And it was fun because some of the images that I produced at 8 stand the test of time today. So very lucky. But Arnie, he started his career much sooner than I did. I had other lives.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky. I was driven to do what I wanted to do, and it seemed like the only choice in life for me. But, you know, you ask about photographers who have inspired us, me. I'm a student of photography. I always have been. I always will be. I've been buying photography books, and it's, again, not unusual for some of our compatriots to have the same thing, but I study photography from day one, the art of photography. And so I've always been inspired by the work of others and curious about the work of others, and I learned a great deal from books. So back in the days, couldn't afford prints from other photographers, so I'd always
buy, at least the ones you admired.
You know, I'd always buy books, and I'd study the books. I'd learn from their work and try to grow my own work by understanding what they were trying to do.
And it's funny, I didn't study photography, I studied art. I mean, I grew up being lucky enough to see the great museums of the world, from the National Gallery to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, the ones in San Francisco, to the Tate, the Louvre, even been to the one in Russia. So our refrigerator is making noises. Anyway, so it's, I grew up with art, so I didn't study photography, but I was immersed in art, light and shadow, line and form, what goes into an image, regardless of the medium. And so I started my career much later. I had other lives. And when my first life was ending, I thought, okay, what do I want to do for the rest of my life? Well, I am a photographer. I'm just going to jump in and do it. And being a woman photographer back in those days wasn't easy. This is back in the early 80s. The guys had it easy. Because but a lot of the art buyers were women, and they'd much rather work with a man than a woman. But one of my mentors was Ernst Haas, and the late Ernst Haas, and he said, "You'll succeed because you're quietly persistent." And so I did, and so was very lucky to again have my work published in the best of the best. So Arnie and I had totally separate careers before we joined lives and businesses. It was pretty cool.
Do you currently,
I'm
sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I used to lead trips north of the Arctic Circle. I was the outdoor camping. I still love the outdoors. So my work tended to be outdoors, with people, nature, whatever. I traveled a lot. I scrounged my way to getting freebies, not all over the world, but, you know, so that I could travel and photograph what were then more exotic places. Now, a lot of people go to Australia and they, you know, go to various places, but I was doing it back when maybe only the National Geographic Traveler and Travel and Leisure and those types of people went, but the common person usually did.
But Margot was doing what was called at that point stock photography, and that was a very viable way to do things. Mine was always assignment work. So, but she was able to, when she jokes about, you know, getting persuading people, there was a standard thing. You'd call up the a country's
embassy
or PR people and say, look, I've got this story I'd like to do. Can you help finance it? Can you find people that would be willing to be part of this? And so it was a great thing. And I was always assignment driven. I always loved the challenge of assignments and doing different kinds of things. So when we met and eventually, you know, combined our lives, it was interesting because, you know, the world's changing, you know, it's constantly changing. And some of the things that were viable when we were around aren't there anymore.
Yeah.
Stock photography is pretty much done for, you know. They've priced the stock photography down to the lowest common denominator, and assignments and for the magazines that I used to work for and the commercial work doesn't exist anymore. So we're lucky to be doing and very happy to be doing what we're doing now.
For your recent photography, do you mainly do only digital photography or do you also combine analog photography as well?
It's digital now.
We were sort of late compared to some of the other people out there because we didn't want to make the switch until it was better
than the Hasselblad that we were using.
Medium format. And that's when we switched to digital and have never looked back. Analog is, you know,
it's magical. It's wonderful.
Well, it's making a resurgence, shall we say, because people never experienced some of the frustrations of. But you know, the digital world is really amazing, and the quality of an image that we get today compared to back when we were shooting film. And not that we're doing anything different in today's, at least for Margot and I. We use a process that I call is basically on the computer, it's called Lightroom. It's the same thing as working in the darkroom. We don't use Photoshop. Our images are not Photoshop, but developed in the same way that we used to do it in the darkroom.
I mean, one of the things I say when we run our workshops, I say Photoshop is not a verb. It is a tool. And so, as Arnie said, we work on an image in traditional ways. It just happens to be a light room instead of a dark room. But the principles are the same. Mm-hmm. And because our work is in museums and galleries and collections, we have a more traditional view of photography. When we make an image or we teach people how to up their photography skills, we always encourage them to look at museum quality work, because you don't see a lot of this hyper-processed, over-saturated work in museums. And so we come from, as I said, maybe a fuddy-duddy point of view, but it's a classic, more of a classic point of view.
Are there any particular cameras that either of you favor or lenses when you're doing your work?
Well, it's in my hand.
Yeah, we always say the best camera you have is the one in your hands. And
it could be that, which is not a fancy one.
Yeah, I mean, in today's world, it's all changing so quickly. But one of the things that we do preach, you know, we do photo workshops, and they're dedicated to the art of
photography.
Photography, the equipment is always secondary to the vision. So we're like many photographers that these cameras today have gotten bigger and heavier, and we're trying to travel lighter. Margot's mentor, Ernst Haas, has a great quote: "The less you carry, the more you see. Mm-hmm. And the more images you'll see." And, you know, so we're kind of down, at least for me. I shoot 90% of how I see the world with a slightly wide angle lens. Margot's maybe a little different, a slightly longer lens.
I switch back and forth a little bit more than Arnie does, because Arnie tends to generally see the broader view, and I tend to get mesmerized by some of the details and the intimate details. Maybe it's partly the difference between men and women, but then sometimes when people go through the book that you've seen, people say, well, that's an Arnie, and that's a Margo. Well, that's an Arnie, and that's a Margo. We said, no, that's an Arnie. They say it is, because obviously I think we've influenced one another's work and so forth.
For sure, but we don't shoot the same way.
Thankfully.
Yeah, it depends on a lot where we're at in the subject matter. Maybe if we're doing sort of landscape things, that it's a little closer, but not the same.
No.
If we're shooting in some place like New Orleans from the book, it's more different, but there are similar things that we're attracted to.
And it's funny, I think we photographed together probably, 25 years now. Mm-hmm. And I think I can only think of one or two instances we have ended up separately coming up with the exact same image. Do you remember the scarecrow in France? And I looked at Arnie's, and he looked at mine.
We don't stand next to
each other. No, and it was absolutely bizarre.
I'll go that way. Once in a while, we'll see a subject
exactly the same way. Just bizarre.
Almost composed exactly the same. And she was over there, and I was over there.
And we didn't even know we'd happened upon the scene. So it was strange.
But I think the other thing that we both enjoy is we don't BS each other. If she doesn't like my image, it's pretty straightforward and vice versa. So I think that also is very good for us, because
keeps you honest.
Yeah, we preach also, if somebody just pats you on the head and says, your work's great, You don't learn anything from that. You try to challenge each other, and grow. We're never stop growing.
We don't want to be static. Absolutely not. I mean, in the workshops, it's funny. I have an expression I say that in our critique sessions, you have to be honest. If you're not honest, it doesn't work. And I say that, you know, we're not like your great aunt Minnie who clasps her hands and says, oh dear, I love everything you do. But that's not how people grow. You have to be brutally honest, but tactful. So you're not, and get people to realize you're not criticizing them. You're critiquing their work. And there's a big, big difference. And once the participants get used to that, it works really well because they realize they can say what they feel. And the other thing is artists, regardless of your medium, you can go into a museum and you might like that painting over there and I might like the one down there in the far corner, while Arnie might prefer the one behind us. And that's good because if we all had the same aesthetic, it would be pretty boring. The fact that we do see differently, we have different biases based on our experiences in life, that's so important. So what we always say is you start with a concept that even before we bring the camera up to our eyes, we have a concept in our brain. Then we say you have to have the vision to put it together. And then without the passion, speaking to the heart, you have to have the passion to bring it out, to bring it alive. You can have the most technically superb photograph and it can be dead to the eye. No appeal whatsoever. So we value aesthetics over techno speak.
And for your workshops, go ahead.
No, I was gonna just say the one thing that we really emphasize in our own work or whatever is if you want it to be unique, you've got to make it personal. How do you do that? You don't record, you interpret. And Margo hit on it. We all have different life experiences and different things that we find interesting. But those are how it's going to separate from somebody else's snapshot. Yeah. What's the difference between a snapshot and a photograph? It's how much input the photographer puts into it.
You can ask a question?
Oh, I was asking about the workshops that you host. Our participants, is it okay if they only had an iPhone, if they're joining, or do you prefer they have a bigger camera, digital camera issue with?
Actually, sometimes we give exercise with an iPhone because my favorite lens is the foot zoom. Mm-hmm. And people get so used to having a lens they can zoom in and out, but they're not using the lens as it was meant to be used. So if you take an iPhone or a Droid or whatever it is, you know, you have to use your foot zoom to get in the right position. Mm-hmm. And it gets them thinking in a different way. But generally, yes, they bring a digital camera. Once in a while, we'll have someone back in film days, but they lose a lot of the critiquing because we come back and then share the images, not all of them, but a select number. And you get instant feedback almost. And we usually repeat one location twice, do it in the beginning and then maybe later in the workshop. So what they didn't get maybe the first time, they have a chance to approach again the second time.
But I think for serious photographers, you know, a camera that you can use that produces a beautiful print. The smartphones all can produce a nice print up to a certain size. Yeah. But, you know, we're always saying to anybody that comes with us that you should be proud enough in the images you produce to hang them on your wall. Mm. And so the smartphones are great for computer screens and other things, but when you get to looking at prints, most people will prefer a camera. I mean, today's world, every time I turn around, there's some new camera coming out with incredible resolution and so forth. And
it's a megapixel war.
Yeah, but in the long run, again, it's a vision. It's not the equipment. The equipment is just there to do what your eye and heart and passion tell it to do. And whatever that is, that's fine. Margot does this assignment on purpose with the iPhone, but
or the smartphone
to give people the idea that it's not the equipment, it's the passion and it's the heart and eye that count.
Yeah, and the whole concept. So it's
and we've, you know, over the years, as I was talking about, we've gone through a couple of different kinds of digital cameras, and we're now using a smaller, lighter camera because these things are getting so freaking heavy to walk around. Even when we try to pare down our equipment with a bunch of heavy digital cameras, it's no fun. So we're down to a fairly small kit, mirrorless camera.
And it's funny because
it's Fuji. We've shot Hasselblad, we've shot Leica, we've shot Rolling. We just recently switched from Nikon to Fuji because
about 4 years ago. Yeah. And it's interesting, the workshops, people see us getting lighter and lighter on our equipment. They say, what are you using? And you know, we tell them, but if people are coming from Canon, Fuji might not be the right choice. You've got to find out what works for you, what isn't the brand. And we say, don't put your money into a good camera, but put your real money into your lenses. Your lenses are what are going to see you through. Mm-hmm. The cameras, they're outdated a week after you buy them. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but that's the principle. Mm-hmm. It's the lenses that see you through, not the other.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
In your book on New Orleans, were there any particular times of the year that you both preferred going down there to document, like Mardi Gras, or you went there like just whenever?
Well, we've been going to New Orleans separately and together for 30 years or
so. For me, it's even more, yeah, I think.
Probably, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, for me, it's 40 years.
I was doing assignments there in the 70s and 80s. So during the workshop, of course, we do it in the end of January, 1st of February, which is also a nice time. It's usually a little warmer there, except one time when the water pipes froze in the whole city, there was no water. But it's a nice time to go there. You know, not only is it's always packed with unusual characters.
Yes.
And we're usually a little bit before Mardi Gras because I think I can deal with crowds like that, but somebody who's not experienced and tries to photograph in a Mardi Gras situation, it can be a little overwhelming.
Well, not only that, but it's one, there are always at certain types of festivals, there are the people would just be just as happy to walk off with your camera or your camera bag. And our people get so engrossed in what they're doing, I frankly am afraid that some of them will just not pay attention to their equipment and it'll be gone. So by doing it before Mardi Gras, a week or so before, you get all the preliminary parades and the bands and gearing up. We go see the Mardi Gras world and the wonderful floats past and present, you know, they're still making them. So it's a good, really good time to go. But overall, some of the images in the book were done at different times of year before Arnie and I met. So you don't see a lot of snow in New Orleans. So in a sense, you're in the city. It really doesn't make that much difference at what time of year you go. Sure, in the parks, the trees will be blooming if you go in the spring. But it really, but, that's not, you know, what we're photographing.
The things that attract both of us, I think, in a city like New Orleans is the personality of New Orleans, you know, and that really is the French Quarter, obviously, the Frenchman area, Marais or Treme areas. Those are the personality of New Orleans. You go over into the high rises, it's just another city.
You go to the garden district. Yeah, and it's, you can't get at some of the buildings. They're all beautifully landscaped. Mm. But honestly, it's nice to wander through, but there's not that much to photograph. It's all the same. Tall fences, shrubbery. Tall fences, shrubbery.
So we do pick our locations of where we go because we find there's a unique vibe, personality mm-hmm. to various places,
to New Orleans,
and wherever we go. Even, you know, the landscape workshops do are picked because the places we go are not always the hip parade things. We're trying to always challenge people. So a personality of the place is important to us.
I mean, we always say, seek your own vision and create great photos. We don't take pictures, we make photographs. And if you think about it, you take pictures and it's more snapshooters, and there's a place for that. I'm not saying there isn't, but we're serious photographers, and the people who join us are mostly serious photographers.
Exactly.
And they're at different stages in their photographic journey. And that's fine, because sometimes a seasoned pro can learn from a rank beginner, because the rank beginner hasn't gotten stuck in a rut. And so sees things more as a child sees the world, and with kind of wonderment and enthusiasm. And that comes out in the photography. So it's, the reason we don't go to the hip parade places as much is that people want to do the iconic shot. Well, it's iconic because everyone else has done it. We want them to seek their own vision, find their own path, find out what speaks to them, just as we do, what speaks to us. Sometimes for Arnie and me, it's the same thing. Sometimes it's something totally different. And in our locations, we've gotten to know the people. We've got to know a number of people in New Orleans. So we go to Charleston, we've got to know people there. I mean, wherever we go to the main coast. We know quite a number of people there. I grew up sailing there. So we don't travel to places as tourists. And one of the people looking at the book said, you don't, several people who actually either grew up in New Orleans or lived there for a long time or went to school there said, these aren't the photographs of a tourist point of view. These are photographs of an insider, someone who knows it well. And that's because something has to speak to us. We have to know it in order to photograph it. Does that make sense? Yeah.
And for some of your interior shots, like the nightclubs and the bars, did you ever incorporate lighting, or you just use like whatever available lights there?
Both.
Well, if you look at a number of my images in the book, you'll see I use a combination of flash and ambient light.
Yeah.
And in the bars and so forth, we sort of will sit there for a while and get to talking to some of the bartender or whatever, and we become part of it. And, you know, then we work into photographing. And it's always, you've got to feel the place and the vibe of the place first, and then proceed. So a flash at certain places is inappropriate.
Absolutely.
In some other places, it's fine. Nobody bothers, cares. But it's you got to just feel these things out.
It's not and a one-size.
It's not walking in what we call machine gunning. It's walking in and getting to be part of whatever situation we're in.
It's not a one size fits all. Many people, we've seen this in Cuba, we've seen this in Key West, will stand way back with a honker lens and photograph somebody across the street. Well, those people have no connection with their subject. We say if you're gonna photograph a person, you have to be in their space and they should be in your space. You have to feel them. You can't photograph people as an object. You have to show them respect. And so you really do have to be in their space. You don't have to have a super wide lens, but you have to have a pretty wide lens and get up close and personal with them. That's how you get the personalities of some of these people to shine through.
And you want to make people, there's exceptions to all this, but you want if you're photographing people in a situation that you're spending time with, you want them to be comfortable with you being there. And they may be doing something totally outrageous, but if they don't, if they think you're sort of part of the what's happening,
yeah,
then you'll get more intimate photographs. As Margo said, you stand across the street with a telephoto and you're just going to get the voyeur types of photographs. Mm-hmm.
And how do you approach your subjects there? Do you have to like usually give them like a release form to sign, or do some of them you sort of just take a sneak photo and just walk off?
Well, I've been a long proponent of copyright issues, intellectual property law. Set up phone trees back in the old days, helped strengthen copyright laws. So this is a subject near and dear to my heart. But in a public setting, you don't have to get a model release. It's public domain, if you will. In the old days, when we were on jobs, we'd go into a place and say, if anyone is here, yeah, with someone they oughtn't to be here, you may want to leave now because we're going to be photographing. But by and large, you don't worry about that in a situation such as New Orleans.
Well, I think one of the things that has to be, with that question, it's the use of the photograph.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So our work is only being used for fine art situations.
Not commercial exhibitions.
Collectors, so forth and so on. So we're not selling these things for advertising or commercial work as we used to. Anytime we were on a commercial assignment, of course, we had we had releases. And
in different languages, you know, even.
So back then, of course. Today, since we're, quote, just doing it for art, those releases aren't necessary. But if somebody says, don't take my picture, we're not going to take their photograph.
Again, it's all part of respect. And sometimes Arnie and I work differently. Sometimes you can ask permission with just lifting up the camera a little bit with a raised eyebrow, or it can be, there are many ways to gesture with someone without engaging in conversation. I sometimes say, if I find someone that's going to be interesting, I want to photograph them. Well, I said, would you mind if I photographed you? And they said, well, they get all shy and that's fine. And I say, no, I don't want you to look at the camera. What you were doing was perfect. I'm not here. And they eventually go back to what they're doing. And then you get the photograph that you want. Other times, there was the old thing of shoot first, ask later.
Yeah, ask for me. You know.
But not when people, we respect people. That's what it's all about. You can't not respect people and maintain a reputation. And even if we weren't photographers who've been in the business a long time, it's not in our being to not respect people. It just, it's not the way we work. Ethics.
Very much.
How has the public reactions been so far to your book? And is anybody like in government there in New Orleans or really cited your book that loved it, you know?
It's, yeah. One of the things about producing a book these days, in the old days, and I used to work for a publishing company back in the Jurassic period, and it was a private company, and an author would come, a new author, and the publishing company would take it on. They'd do all the PR. They'd arrange for the book tours. They'd do the advertising. They'd do the movie rights. They'd find the overseas partner publishers. These days, it ain't so, as they say. And so even for well-established authors, and we have several in our town, they have to do it themselves. They have to do their own book tours, their own PR. So what we're doing now, the book just came out in November. So we're in the process of getting it into bookstores. And with the pandemic, we're not about to travel to New Orleans to schlep the book around. And so it's being done bit by bit. I've got several bookstores in New Orleans who are interested. I've sent them PDFs, the stuff that I sent you, and they're interested. But during the pandemic, because they're not getting foot traffic, they are not going to engage, they're not going to take as many books. And that's perfectly reasonable. I can't blame them. So.
Well, COVID certainly has impacted the whole world of publishing and, you know,
and art,
and everything. Mm-hmm. Margaret, I'll get back to the main point in a second, but we have a lot of friends in New Orleans that are street musicians, yeah, and they make their living by tips. I mean, that they're in dire straits now.
Yeah.
But the thing with COVID and us, we're on the road constantly before. And it's been part of our lives. People would say, how do
separately
you do it?
And
but, you know, we actually love it. But with the pandemic, it gave us some time when we looked at each other and said, now's the time to do a book.
Oh, let me step in. So Arnie has this thing. He says, I have an idea. And one of the things I love about Arnie is his irreverence. And when he says, I have an idea, I just wait for the whatever the bomb is gonna drop. So he said, I have an idea. And I look at him suspiciously and I say, yeah, what is it this time? He said, we're gonna do a book on New Orleans. He said, okay, knowing that there is a ton that goes into a project like this. And because I'm the computer person, I knew a lot of this was going to end up in my lap, practically speaking.
She's so talented.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. So it was the right time. During the pandemic, we had the time to do it. And it's something we've wanted to do for a long time, whether it be Cuba or New Orleans or other types of things that people have asked us to do. But New Orleans is kind of a natural. It's within the States. We don't have to worry about trying to market it in Cuba and stuff like that. And so we knuckled down last, actually we had an exhibition at a gallery in a nearby town.
2 years.
2 years ago, January.
Some of the work from New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was part of what springboard went into the book. But the other end of this is when you sort of self-publish like we did, and we took, there was no expense spared in the
printing.
Reproduction.
Printing is gorgeous.
And couldn't be happier with it. It's way beyond just a normal easy print book. But that's impacting us right now, is trying to get the book out to certain places. And, you know, they don't have the foot traffic that they would. The museum stores are saying, not now,
yeah,
you know, when this is
call
over.
Call us later, yeah, please let us know.
We'll take the book, but nobody's buying anything in the places it would be appropriate for this kind of book. So right now, I mean, we've had great response to people who know our work in a lot of purchases, but we still have a lot of books sitting in the garage.
One of our friends in New Orleans, or someone, an amazing musician with whom we're very friendly, sent her, she's been amazing and been very patient with our participants when they photograph her. So in thanks, I sent her a book and she loved it. She said, oh my, she waxed enthusiastically, as has anyone who knows New Orleans well. They just say, I can't wait to go back. So, and even those who have never been say, oh, I can't wait to go. So it really has had a good impact on people, which is wonderful, because I think regardless of your art form, if you reach your audience, it is very gratifying. It's very special.
Hello, thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break.
So were there any, when you're both documenting New Orleans for your book, were there certain things about the city that you noticed changes in the last past couple of decades, like post, you know, Hurricane Katrina, or you noticed any sort of like, maybe like immigrant populations, like people are kind of moving into the city or anything like that?
Well,
very much so. Yeah. I mean, from the 80s, when I was first there, it was a much rawer city. You had dives with pole dancers enticing, you know, guys with their drinks to come in and put $5 bills in various places. It was seedier. It had a certain charm. It still
has a certain seedy charm, and that's why we go there. But it is...
It's been cleaned up a little bit.
I mean, today, and you know, when we're there, every morning on Bourbon Street and the streets up and down the French Quarter, they clean the streets because of what happened the night before in the streets. And so, I mean, that was, we were both surprised that they're doing that. That, I mean, when we went back years ago, so that's not new now, but it was compared to, say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago when we first started, or longer going there. Yes. And as Margo said, it's still a unique, wonderful, raw city full of interesting characters. But it's not as raw as it once was. I mean, there is no question. So,
and talking about immigration, you know, I don't know if Arnie is, I haven't been particularly aware of the change in the demographics. You have, you know, purple, white, green chartreuse. It's always been a bit of a mix there. You know, you get the Acadiens, the people who came, who were ousted from the Northeast. You've got the Black population. You've got the Indian population. I mean, you know, native nations, I should say. It's a mix. It's everything.
Part of the history of New Orleans French. Is the uniqueness of the...
It was built on immigration.
Yeah, I mean, the different cultures that came, the music cultures, the food cultures, all those things came together in New Orleans. And we love it because of that. It's, you know, the Cajuns, just the mix of interesting people who do hold on to their own
traditions
mm-hmm. and their characters. They were very proud of, you know, being Cajun, being local. It's like any, but unfortunately, the cost to live in, say, the French Quarter is crazy. But even a little very famous area called Treme, which was just a few blocks from where we do our, you know, our hotel, is becoming gentrified. But that's, you know, any cities like that. So there was a great TV series after Katrina called Treme that really got into the personality of New Orleans. And also, that's still there, music, food, goofy, wonderful people, all part of it.
The show is amazing because it got into the good, bad, and the ugly that came out of Katrina, from the corruption to people helping people, to the fact that the show hired local musicians, local people to act. I think there was only one, maybe two actors who weren't native to New Orleans. So it does have its own personality. If you think of the history of New Orleans, it's this wonderful mélange of people. And it for us, it's very exciting.
Do both of you, Arnie and Margo, mind sharing what are some of the biggest joys and challenges of being a photographer?
Coming up with the next great image.
I mean, in our lives, I think both of us, you know, there's incredible highs and incredible lows that one minute you love everything you do, the next minute you look at the same thing, how did I do that? It's terrible. So a little bit of fear, a little bit of always pushing, but you know, it is an incredible journey. The idea of being a creative person is different. I'm sure you're the same way. A different mentality than most. And so you're always wondering, can I do it better? Can I do it differently? Why am I doing this? I don't want to be like everybody else. So it's really trying to then show, I make a comment at times, are you the photographer that shoots what people expect to see? or are you the photographer who wants to photograph and show them what you see? And we're that second person.
Yeah,
we're trying to show how we feel about the subject. And sometimes it works better than others.
I think, you know, Arnie said fear. That may have been because of the difference in our careers before we joined forces. To me, I look at more as challenge, because we return to the same places over and over and over again, which means we know it pretty well, which means we've seen it a ton of times. So for us, the challenge is each time we photograph a certain area or a certain musician or a certain building, how are we going to do it differently? How are we going to bring a different interpretation to that particular subject? That is the challenge. And as Arnie said, sometimes we succeed, and sometimes I'll go back to the room at night and say, I don't feel like a photographer today. I just couldn't, it didn't come together for me. And he'll say, yeah, I had one of those yesterday. It's part of the creative process to keep trying to think outside of the box, to keep your creative juices going, to come at things in a different, from a different direction, to get a different take on things. And I think that's a constant challenge for us both. And also, you know, when we're teaching, we try to instill that in others too. And when we were for each one of the photographs in the book, there's a story behind each one of those, you know, of what we went through when we were photographing it. They're like children or pets. You don't forget them, you know. So it sounds like an odd analogy, but artists know what we mean.
Mm-hmm. And how did you approach the publishing company Brilliant to help with the printing?
That was, it was difficult and it was easy. So when we started out, and I've been in publishing, so I knew the jargon, I knew the terms, but where do you start? So we looked through the spines of art books that Arnie has, and our colors are, well, I'll get into that in a minute. So we talked to some friends, and one said, you should look at Brilliant Publishing. And
another photographer who was actually printing his books in Italy, but he said, I'm going to come back and start publishing his books here, and he was thinking of Brilliant.
And so we did a cold call. I called Bob Tursak there, and I sent him some preliminaries. He liked the sound of us. We seemed to be on the same wavelength, a sense of humor, a little bit of irreverence, things like that. So he asked us to send him some stuff, and he came back, oh, wow. This is beautiful. We're going to have fun together. And when we were talking to him, I said to Arnie later, we were interviewing him as much as he was interviewing us, because in a publishing venture, particularly during COVID-19, but even so, you have to have a partnership. You have to have a common goal. You have to have mutual respect. And we developed it. And normally in the book, Brilliant. They published Sally Mann's 1,000 Crossings, which is jointly curated by the National Gallery of Art and the Essex Peabody Museum. And I figured, you know, we figured if it's good enough for them, it's probably good enough for us. And it turned out to be true because of the nature of some of our photographs, which you've already seen, the colors are way out of gamut. They're way out of the norm for the printing. They're way out of the normal CMYK range that most printing is done in. And Brilliant saw this, and they actually mixed up, in addition to the CM standard CMYK, they mixed up a special violet and a special green. They added what they call a skeletal black, which almost looks like a ghost image of some of the blacks in the book. Then they topped it off with a spot varnish. So basically, instead of four color, it was seven color plus the spot printing. And it was that attention to detail that we had the trust in Bob and his team at Brilliant. And they went with it, and we went with it, and we couldn't have been more pleased.
If I may, there's this whole thing that, you know, books are done because you have to do them. at least for us. And I think most, it's not a little coffee, you know, I went here for. It is our life's work that we're trying to get across. In New Orleans, I keep using the word vibe, but that vibe also is the color of New Orleans.
Yes.
And our work is not punched up colors. It is not over contrast. It's not that. It is sort of, as I said before, you know,
it's a vibrant. Little work it's vibrant.
In the dark room to bring out what we saw. But those are the colors of New Orleans.
Yeah.
So when we were first looking at the book, Bob or Brilliant had the facility to print it in China. Well, we kept going back and forth over this, and eventually he said, look, if you really want to make the work look like you want, China can't do it.
Yeah.
And we just looked at each other and said, oh shit, we're basically in this now.
It's only money.
it's our lives. So if we're going to do this, we're going to do it to make the printing look as almost the same as an original print.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that we found Brilliant to be very, very
responsive
and capable of doing what we wanted to do.
And also,
and we couldn't be happier.
And they also thought outside of the box too, to figure out how they could replicate the colors of our images. So it really was a wonderful team effort, and it just was. Yeah.
We could have probably saved many thousands of dollars by cutting
corners.
We didn't want to do it. And how the printing would look and the colors, and we weren't willing to do that.
No.
So again, as any author, so you want to be proud of what's on those pages, and they did it right. We never went there. We also, because of COVID, we weren't going to go someplace, and we had to trust them, and they did it.
But they also, I mean, there were some FedExes back and forth. They sent some proof prints down, one before they had added that skeletal black to which I referred, and there were two press proofs, and I looked at it, I said, that's a no-brainer. Definitely need the skeletal black. So there was a lot of communication back and forth all along the way. And we kept our designer, Andy Lyons, in the loop too. So because he was a top corporate annual report designer who'd won numerous awards. And so we knew about the printing process when Bob said, we're going to use XYZ paper. Andy said, perfect. I know that paper. It's really good choice. And so he added input that helped, and it was really very collaborative. And wow, we're pleased.
Do you mind sharing about your work in Cuba? I'm really interested in that because my father's side of the family and my grandmother was from Havana. I've never been there, but my father used to go there back in the 1950s before Castro took power. So I'd love to learn more about your documentation there.
Well, this
again,
is
not documentation, okay. Interpretation.
One of the things, I mean, we love Cuba. We think Cuba and the people of Cuba.
We have friends there.
Forget the government's issues and all that, but the people in Cuba are actually some of the nicest, friendliest, most warm people we have ever met anywhere in the world.
Yes.
So our workshops in Cuba were a little different. The first thing, once we land there, you know, and a lot of people go, oh, where are the pretty old cars? I said, first of all, you will not photograph an old car until you understand what they mean to the Cuban people.
Their family members.
So the idea of going there as a tourist and doing the cliche photograph of old cars, that's not what we're about, and that's what we tried to get our people who came with us to see. We came there to see and experience the culture of Cuba. And it is, as I said, it is just for us, besides New Orleans, Cuba is our most favorite place to go. We hope to return soon.
We keep our fingers crossed.
I mean, all the growth we saw during our workshops here, the change is because, you know, we could go there, we could talk to people. People saw us differently, saw the Americans differently. And yeah, there was a lot of other workshops, but they'd stand on, as Marco said before, they'd go stand on the corner and photograph the cars. We go into people's homes.
We were invited into people's houses and homes, and they were very modest, but it didn't make any difference. I remember once I peered inside a door and there was a huge sow in the hallway of this apartment.
In Havana.
La Habana. And there was, it didn't smell a pig at all. And the lady, the owners, you know, invited me in, and I had one of our workshop people with us. She'd come on in. And then the Cuban people are indomitable. They don't complain. There's a lesson that many of our countrymen could take from them. They are thankful for what they have. They do not wish for what they know they cannot have. And it's a wonderful philosophy. Well, no, I mean, they do want a better life for themselves, but they don't sit there and bellyache because it's not going to do them anymore. They can wish they work hard, but they're not going to bellyache. They sit, they're a very engaged people. They'll sit on their stoops and talk to the neighbor there or across the way, and very community minded. And the children will play, you know, soccer or what they call football or whatever on the streets. One of our people who was a little nervous about going to Cuba really nailed it when he said, the children are happy. He said, happy children don't come from unhappy families. Now, it's not to say, as Arnie said, they don't want more out of life, don't want more for their children, but the children are happy.
But one of the things that we did see, and it was killed, shall we say, recently, was the growth of people, small businesses, mm-hmm. a little entrepreneurship, all that kind of stuff. Well, recently that all vanished because that was based on some the tourists, the Americans actually coming there. And so, you know, the last administration hurt the Cuban people more than their own government, because there was this hope and the things were improving as far as what they thought they could do and yes. how they could do things. And so that's, you know, we haven't been there now in 5 years, but we hope to return soon because the people were delightful.
Well, there are a couple of examples. In the beginning, when we first went, everything was a government restaurant. And frankly, they weren't very good. And then bit by bit, as more people came, there were small restaurants opened up. There were private restaurants out in Vinales Valley in the West, in the tobacco country. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful country. The one woman got together sort of farm to table and got the growers to really work on that type of thing.
And she kind become of become organic farmers yes. and produce a lot more than they quote were under the restrictions of their own government. So she was in the forefront, and we're sure that her whole philosophy is collapsed.
She's amazing. Yeah, she was amazing. Or in La Habana, you find this little stand. Someone will be sitting with the. They'll do. Peel the oranges in front of you and hand them to you. Or they're, what are those things they fry up? I can't even remember. But, you know, little, what we call food trucks, only there were stands where they'd sell you this, that, or the other thing. One of the things we did see, which was unfortunate in our view, that when the cruise ships came in, unfortunately, a lot of those people came in, they went down the main drag, they saw the things that you were supposed to see. They got back in on the ship, and they really didn't spend money amongst the Cuban people. Our groups, we go off in the back streets. We go probably some places maybe we shouldn't go, but we know photographers who are Cuban, and they keep us out of dangerous places. So we get to explore more than most people do. and get to know people. And they, year after year, they'd recognize us. There was one little bar we'd go to, oh, you're back, they'd say. Or at the boxing thing, you know, you're back. I mean, it was wonderful to have people remember us from year to year. But the cruise ships, there's one famous square, and it used to be the old bookstalls. You could see in any language, you could find a book, and you'd see maybe a Hemingway book in English, you might see in Spanish, you might see it in German, who knows what. And then they turned that into a tourist, all this crud, crud probably made in China or Taiwan.
But I think,
or wherever.
You know,
go if you can. Yeah. You will love it. You'll absolutely love
especially
it.
Especially if things politically in the States change a little bit and go back to where a little more open policy. And it was, you know, we're not talking about governments here. I don't want to get into the government stuff, but it's the people who are absolutely wonderful.
Delightful.
And they learned as much about us as we did about them.
Which is partly what made it work because on our side of the Straits of Florida, we'd gotten one spiel and they were getting another spiel on their side. And we get together and find out, you know, hey, we're really all the same. We want the same thing for our children. We want the same thing for our parents. We want the same things for ourselves. We're all the same. And it's only the government that was keeping us apart. So we were privileged to get to know some of these people and look forward to seeing them again. So it's pretty special. I mean, people, I had one woman made a connection and, oh, I know what was, it was the religious of Santeria, which is the religion down there. It's a combination of, it's
Catholic and voodoo
and whatnot. All sorts of. And there was I was with one of our photographer friends and was just looking at this festival inside.
In the house. There was a ceremony going on within the house. And Margot being Margot, of course.
No, I didn't know. An arm came out and dragged me in.
So and our Cuban friend, the photographer, great talent, looked with his eyes, oh my God, how did that happen? But the priestess saw Margot out there. She felt a connection.
Or the and energy dragged, or something.
Dragged her in. I think she was probably dancing in the street.
definitely dancing in the street. Yes.
So the priestess brought her in. And even our Cuban friend said, I've never seen that happen before.
She said, even with us Cuban people who aren't Santeria, it doesn't happen.
So, you know, it goes back to our philosophy about being open
and engaged.
Trying to learn and be part of the community instead of standing off and
observing from a distance. Yeah. So you want to go to Cuba?
I've been wanting to go for years. Yeah. I hope to go soon. Are you two currently working on any upcoming projects or you plan to collaborate again on another photo book soon?
Guess what?
We need to, once we sell this one, Cuba. It's Cuba.
Yeah. Cuba is the next book.
Yep.
That's great.
Absolutely.
It'll be different to reading than most.
For sure. That's great.
But Cuba, again, because we're attracted to the unique personality of the people in Cuba. And our book will be about the people and, you know, the experience, not the
connection. Yeah, we call it the connection with the people.
But
that's what makes it.
If we, this is all a labor of love. We knew we were not going to probably recoup all the money we put into the book on New Orleans, but we'd like to come close. So we've got to make sure this one isn't financially, we don't lose our whole shirt on this one.
Yeah, half a shirt's okay.
It's going to take a while.
That's okay. We love the response we've been getting.
That's great. Arnie and Margot, are there any unusual stories you'd like to share about your adventures in photography in different parts of the world?
Oh, I've got one.
Go ahead.
Yes. So many years ago when I turned pro and I was in Paris. I always took my kids out of school for a couple of weeks, much to the consternation of the principals. But I figured they'd learn more traveling and seeing life firsthand. So we went to Paris, and it was April, and it was raining. And I was standing on a bridge by Notre Dame, and it was in the days I had my old Kodak Retina 2C camera, and I had to protect the lens before I made the photograph. And I was looking through to get just the right angle that I wanted of the cathedral. And a man, a gentleman, walks by and says in French, and I speak fluent French, he said, "Madam, your lens cap is on." I said, "Yes, sir. I know I'm a professional, but I'm protecting the lens from the rain." He about faces.
Well, I chime in here. A Frenchman in a trench coat and a beret and three ladies.
Well, no, one woman and two smallish kids. Children. Not exactly hit on material. So anyway, he comes, he helps me. And he clearly likes what I'm doing. So he said, Vite, we must go quickly, vite. And so fast, quickly, quickly. So we scuttle through the streets of Paris, and my kids are saying, "Mom, we're following a strange man in a trench coat." I said, "It's okay. There are three of us and one of him." And so we go through the streets and we're talking. My grandmother studied piano under a famous musician there, and we're talking about philosophy, our longtime love of Paris, our love of photography, and the conversation is rolling and the kids are catching snatches of it. Well, he takes us up to the top of La Samaritaine, which is the old department store in Paris. And in those days, it's being refurbished, but you could access it then. And up at the top, there is a 360 degree view. And you'll see Sacré-Cœur, and there'll be an etching of Sacré-Cœur on this sort of brushed aluminum thing, and then the label below, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But on the way up, we stop, and we're just looking over this huge atrium. And I said, this could have been designed by Eiffel or Eiffel. And he said, "How did you know?" And I said, "Well, no, I didn't. But it just reminds me of the laciness of the tower." And we go up top, and we're photographing. I'll say, "Oh, look at the lights. Isn't it beautiful down there?" He said, "Yes, and look at that." And so we're just feeding off one another.
He was carrying a small, discreet
camera.
And if you're into photography, you'll know who it is.
So I come back, and this is years before I met Arnie, and I tell him the story. He said, had to be Henri Cartier-Bresson. I said, "Sure, right, yeah, And because Cartier-Bresson was always behind the camera, he didn't want notoriety. He wanted to be able to photograph anonymously. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Yeah, sure, yeah." And we're watching this, it used to be Ovation TV, and we're watching this program, and I said, "Holy, it was Henri Cartier-Bresson, OMG. And the thing that made it so wonderful is when we were scuttling along the streets of Paris, we didn't introduce each other. It was just two photographers sharing a passion about so many common interests. So when we're through, he said, "Now, madam, where are you going to eat tonight?" And I said, "I don't have the foggiest. We just landed in Paris this morning." "I have just the place." And so he takes us this wonderful little mom and pop Italian restaurant. He said, "But you will have to buy your wine." And so he takes me to the package store next door, and for under $2 procures a wonderful red, introduced me to the couple. And I said, "Sir, you've been so kind. Won't you stay and dine with us?" "Oh, no. I have an appointment. I must be off." And I said, "I'm so sorry we delayed you." And he said, no. "It's been an absolute wonderful time. Don't apologize. It was my pleasure." So, and that was my story.
Wow.
Cartier-Bresson is, one of the most famous and important photographers. And for him to take Margot under his wing for an afternoon in Paris is pretty special. But, to do that, he had to also find something that he thought worthy in her work and how she was approaching it. I'm sure he wouldn't.
He hadn't seen my work, but just my approach.
Watching.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that story is pretty hard to top. But I think the wonderful thing about for both of us is the experiences that we've had in our lives through photography. You know, we're self-employed and there's ups and downs mm-hmm. and frustrations and all that.
And elations.
Yeah. But in the long run, it's just the whole experience in the language of photography has been incredible.
And the wonderful people we've met on this journey and continue to meet on this journey has been astounding, absolutely astounding. From all walks of life, all stripes, spots, and colors, it's been truly a gift that photography has given us.
Well, I look forward to seeing more of your work and then your future and seeing your book on Cuba.
It may be a couple of years.
Yeah.
Hello. Thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break. Thanks for tuning in to this latest episode of the Erratic Dispatches podcast, featuring interviews with photographers Arnold Arnie Zan and Margot Taussig Pinkerton, discussing their book New Orleans, as well as their professional careers. I've pasted links on the profile page of this podcast episode, in which you can check out Arnie and Margot's official websites, and also check out their calendar for upcoming events, and also there's a link to purchase their book. Thanks for tuning in. I'll be back soon with a new episode. Take care. Bye-bye.